dizzy. Roger, I'm...
Where has he gone?
It was her father, soaking wet and grim as death, Dirk in his hand. That... She turned to point, but he was already gone, running wolf-like. She saw the marks of Bonnet's passage now, the scuffed footmarks clear in the muddy sand. Before she could turn round again, Roger was after him. Wait! She shrieked. But no answer came save the rapidly receding rustle of brush as heavy bodies flung themselves heedlessly through. She stood still for a moment, head hanging as she breathed. The rain was pooling in the sockets of Emmanuel's open eyes. The orange light glowed in them, making them look like the eyes of a Japanese movie monster. That random thought passed across her mind, then vanished, leaving her blank and numb. She wasn't sure what to do at this point. There were no sounds from the beach anymore. The noises of Bonnet's flight had long since faded. The rain was still falling, but the last of the sun shone through the wood, the long rays nearly horizontal, filling the space between the shadows with an odd shifting light that seemed to waver as she watched, as though the world around her were about to disappear. In the midst of it, dreamlike, she saw the women appear, the Fulani twins. They turned the identical faces of fawns to her, huge eyes black with fear, and ran into the wood. She called out to them, but they disappeared. Feeling unutterably tired, she trudged after them. She didn't find them, nor was there a sign of anyone else. The light began to die, and she turned back, limping, toward the house. She ached everywhere, and began to suffer from the illusion that there was no one left in the world but her. Nothing but the burning light, fading to ashes moment by moment. Then she remembered the baby in her womb, and felt better. No matter what, she wasn't alone. Nonetheless, she gave a wide berth to the place where she thought Emmanuel's body lay. She had meant to circle back toward the house, but went too far. As she turned to go back, she caught a glimpse of them, standing together in the shelter of the trees on the other side of a stream. The wild horses, tranquil as the trees around them, flanks gleaming, bay and chestnut, and black with the wet. They raised their heads, scenting her, but didn't run, only stood regarding her with big, gentle eyes. The rain had stopped when she reached the house. Ian sat on the stoop, wringing water out of his long hair. "You've mud on your face, Ian," she said, sinking down beside him.
"Oh, have I?"
he said, giving her a half-smile.
"How is it then, cuz?"
"Oh, I think I'm fine." "What?" She gestured at his shirt, stained with watery blood. Something seemed to have hit him in the face. Besides the smudges of mud, his nose was puffed. There was a swelling just above his brow, and his clothes were torn as well as wet. He drew a deep, deep breath and sighed, as though he were as tired as she was.
"I got back the wee black lass," he said. "Phaedra."
That pierced the dreamlike fugue that filled her mind, but only a little.
"Phaedra," she said,
the name feeling like that of someone she had once known, long ago.
"Is she all right?"
"Where?"
"In there."
Ian nodded back toward the house, and she became aware that what she had thought the sound of the sea was, in fact, someone weeping. The small sobs of someone who has already wept herself to exhaustion, but cannot stop.
"Nay, leave her to herself, cuz."
Ian's hand on her arm stopped her from rising.
"You canna help."
"But..." He stopped her, reaching into his shirt. From around his neck, he took a battered wooden rosary and handed it to her.
"She'll maybe want this later. I picked it up from the sand after the ship left."
For the first time since her escape, the nausea was back, a sense of vertigo that threatened to pull her down into blackness.
"Josh," she whispered,
Ian nodded silently, though it hadn't been a question.
"I'm sorry, cuz," he said, very softly.
It was nearly dark when Roger appeared at the edge of the wood. She hadn't been worrying, only because she was in a state of shock too deep even to think of what was happening. At sight of him, though, she was on her feet and flying toward him, all the fears she had suppressed erupting at last into tears running down her face like rain. "Dar," she said, choking and sniffling into his wet shirt. "Is he?
"He's all right, Bree. Can you come with me? Are you strong enough? Just for a bit?"
Gulping and wiping her nose on the soggy arm of her shift, she nodded, and, leaning on his arm, limped into the darkness under the trees. Bonnet was lying against a tree, head lolling to one side. There was blood on his face, running down onto his shirt. She felt no sense of victory at sight of him, only an infinitely weary distaste. Her father was standing silently under the same tree. When he saw her, he stepped forward and folded her wordlessly into his arms. She closed her eyes for one blissful moment, wanting nothing more than to abandon everything, let him pick her up like a child, and carry her home. But they had brought her here for a reason. With immense effort, she lifted her head and looked at Bonnet. Did they want congratulations? She wondered fuzzily. But then she remembered what Roger had told her, describing her father leading her mother through the scene of butchery, making her look so that she would know her tormentors were dead.
Okay, she said, swaying a little. All right, I see, he's dead. Well, no, actually, he isn't.
Roger's voice held an odd note of strain, and he coughed with a look that shot daggers at her father.
"Do you want him dead, lass?"
Her father touched her shoulder gently.
"It is your right."
"Do I?" She looked wildly from one to the other of the grave, shadowed faces, then at Bonnet, realizing for the first time that blood was running down his face. Dead men, as her mother had often explained, don't bleed. They had found Bonnet, Jamie said, running to earth like a fox, and set about him. It had been an ugly fight, close to, with knives, as their pistols were useless in the wet. Knowing that he fought for his life, Bonnet had struck viciously. There was a red-stained gash in the shoulder of Jamie's coat, a scratch high on Roger's throat where a knife blade had passed within a fraction of slashing his jugular. But Bonnet had fought to escape and not to kill, retreating into a space between trees where only one could come at him. He had grappled with Jamie, thrown him off, then bolted. Roger had given chase and, boiling with adrenaline, had thrown himself at Bonnet bodily, knocking the pirate headfirst into the tree he now lay against.
"So there he lies," Jamie said, giving Bonnet a bleak eye. "I had hoped he'd broken his neck, but no such thing, alas." "He is unconscious," Roger said, and swallowed.
She understood, and in her present mood this particular male quirk of honour seemed reasonable. To kill a man in fair fight, or even an unfair fight, was one thing. To cut his throat while he lay unconscious at your feet was another. But she hadn't understood at all. Her father wiped his dirk on his breeches and handed it to her, hilt first.
"What? Me?"
She was too shocked even to feel astonishment. The knife was heavy in her hand.
"If you wish it," her father said, with grave courtesy. "If not, Roger Mack or I will do it. But it is your choice, Anian."
Now she understood Roger's look. They'd been arguing about it before he had come to fetch her. And she understood exactly why her father offered her the choice. Whether it was vengeance or forgiveness, she held the man's life in her hand. She took a deep breath, the awareness that it wouldn't be vengeance coming over her with something like relief.
"Brianna," Roger said softly, touching her arm, "say the word if you'll have him dead. I'll do it."
She nodded and took a deep breath. She could hear the savage longing in his voice. He did. She could hear the choked sound of his voice in memory, too, when he had told her of killing Bobble, when he woke from dreams of it, drenched in sweat. She glanced at her father's face, nearly drowned in shadow. Her mother had said only a little of the violent dreams that haunted him since Culloden, but that little was enough. She could hardly ask her father to do this, to spare Roger what he suffered himself. Jamie raised his head, feeling her eyes on him, and met her gaze straight on. Jamie Fraser had never turned from a fight he saw as his, but this wasn't his fight, and he knew it. She had a sudden flash of awareness. It wasn't Roger's fight either, though he would take the weight of it from her shoulders, and gladly. If we don't kill him here and now... Her chest was tight, and she stopped for breath. What will we do with him?
Take him to Wilmington, her father said, matter-of-factly. The committee of safety there is strong, and they know him for a pirate. They'll deal with him by law, or what passes for it now.
They'd hang him. He would be just as dead. But his blood wouldn't be on Roger's hands or in his heart. The light was gone. Bonnet was no more than a lumpen shape dark against the sandy ground. He might die of his wounds, she thought, and dimly hoped so. It would save trouble. But if they took him to her mother, Claire would be compelled to try to save him. She never turned from a fight that was hers either, Brianna thought wryly, and was surprised to feel a small lightening of spirit at the thought. "Let him live to be hanged, then," she said quietly, and touched Roger's arm. "Not for his sake. For yours and mine. For your baby." For an instant she was sorry that she'd told him now, in the night-dark wood. She would so much have liked to see his face. Chapter 109. All the news that's fit to print. From Longyon, Intelligencer, September the 25th, 1775. A royal proclamation. A proclamation was issued in London upon the 23rd of August, in which His Majesty George the Third proclaims the American colonies to be in a state of open and avowed rebellion. Nothing but our own exertions may defeat the ministerial sentence of death or abject submission. The Continental Congress in Philadelphia has now rejected the objectionable proposals put forth by Lord North, intended to promote the object of reconciliation. The delegates to this Congress state unequivocally the right of the American colonies to raise appropriations and to have a say in the disbursement of same. The statement of the delegates reads in part, "As the British ministry has pursued its ends and prosecuted hostilities with great armaments and cruelty, can the world be deceived into an opinion that we are unreasonable, or can it hesitate to believe with us that nothing but our own exertions may defeat the ministerial sentence of death or abject submission?" A falcon stoops but is deprived of her prey. Upon the 9th of August, HMS Falcon, commanded by Captain John Lindsay, gave chase to two American schooners returning from the West Indies to Salem, Massachusetts. One schooner was captured by Captain Lindsay, who then pursued the other into Gloucester Harbour. Troops upon the shore fired upon the Falcon, which did return this fire, but was then forced to withdraw, losing both schooners, two barges, and 35 men. A notorious pirate condemned. One Stephen Bonnet, known as a pirate and infamous smuggler, was tried before the Wilmington Committee of Safety, and upon testimony of his crimes having been presented by a number of persons, was convicted of them and sentenced to death by drowning. An alarm is raised regarding prowling bands of Negroes who have despoiled a number of farms near Wilmington and Brunswick. Unarmed, save for clubs, the ruffians have stolen livestock, food, and 4 hogsheads of rum. Congress conceives a plan for currency redemption. 2 million Spanish dollars in bills of credit now issue forth from the presses, with $1 million more authorized by Congress, which now announces a plan for the redemption of this currency. That is, that each colony must assume responsibility for its portion of the debt and must redeem the same in 4 installments. These to be paid upon the last day of November in the years 1779, 1780, 1781, and 1782. Chapter 110. The Smell of Light. October the 2nd, 1775. It wasn't thinkable to return Phedre to River Run, even though she technically remained the property of Duncan Cameron. We had discussed the matter at some length, and finally decided not to tell Jocasta that her slave had been recovered, though we did send brief word with Ian when he went to collect Jemmy, telling of Brianna's safe return and regretting the loss of Joshua, omitting a good bit of detail regarding the whole affair. "Should we tell them about Neil Forbes?" I'd asked, but Jamie had shaken his head.
"Forbes will not trouble any member of my family again," he said definitely. "And to tell my aunt or Duncan about it. I think Duncan has sufficient trouble on his hands. He'd feel obliged to take issue with Forbes, and that's a stramash it doesn't need to start just now. As for my aunt..."
He didn't complete the statement, but the bleakness of his countenance spoke well enough. The Mackenzies of Leoch were a vengeful lot, and neither he nor I would put it past Jocasta to invite Neil Forbes to dinner and poison him.
"Always assuming that Mr. Forbes is accepting dinner invitations these days," I joked uneasily. "Do you know what Ian did with the,
"He said he was going to feed it to his dog," Jamie replied thoughtfully. "But I dinna ken, was he serious or not?"
Phedre had been a good deal shocked, both by her experiences and by the loss of Josh, and Brianna insisted that we bring her back to the Ridge with us, to recover, until we could find a reasonable place for her.
"We have to get Aunt Jocasta to free her," Bree had argued.
"I think that will not be difficult," Jamie had assured her with a certain grimness, not knowing what we knew. "But wait a bit, until we find a place for the lass. Then I'll see to it."
As it was, that particular matter took care of itself with stunning abruptness. I opened the door to a knock one afternoon in October, to find 3 weary horses and a pack mule in the dooryard, and Jocasta, Duncan, and the black butler Ulysses standing on the stoop. The sight of them was so utterly incongruous that I merely stood there gaping at them, until Jocasta said acerbically,
"Well, lass, do you mean us to stand here until we're melted away like sugar in a dish of tea?"
It was, in fact, raining quite hard, and I stepped back so quickly to let them in that I trod on Adso's paw. He uttered a piercing yowl which brought Jamie out of his study, Mrs. Bug and Amy from the kitchen, and Phedre out of the surgery, where she had been grinding herbs for me.
"Fair."
Duncan's jaw dropped, and he took 2 steps toward her. He stopped abruptly, just before taking her into his arms, but his face suffused with joy.
"Fair,"
said Jocasta, sounding utterly astounded. Her face had gone quite blank with shock. Ulysses said nothing, but the look on his face was one of unalloyed horror. Within a second it was gone, replaced by his usual austere expression of dignity. But I'd seen it, and kept a narrow eye on him during the ensuing confusion of exclamations and embarrassments. Finally, I got them all out of the front hall. Jocasta suffered a diplomatic headache, though seeing her drawn face I thought it wasn't entirely feigned, and was escorted upstairs by Amy, who put her to bed with a cold compress. Mrs. Bug went back into the kitchen, excitedly revising the supper menu. Phedre, looking frightened, disappeared, doubtless to take refuge in Brianna's cabin,
and tell her all about the unexpected arrival, which meant there would be another three for supper. Ulysses went to deal with the horses, leaving Duncan at last alone to explain matters to Jamie in the study.
"We are emigrating to Canada," he said, closing his eyes and inhaling the aroma of the glass of whiskey in his hands, as though it were smelling salts.
He looked like he needed them. He was gaunt, and his face was nearly as grey as his hair.
"Canada?" Jamie said, as surprised as I was. "For God's sake, Duncan, what have you been doing?"
Duncan smiled wearily, opening his eyes.
"More what I didna do, McDo," he said.
Brianna had told us about the disappearance of the secret hoard of gold, and had mentioned something about Duncan's dealings with Lord Dunsmore in Virginia, but had been vague about it, understandably so, as she'd been kidnapped a few hours afterward and had no details.
"I should never have believed matters could come to such a pass, nor so quickly," he said, shaking his head.
Loyalists had gone suddenly from being a majority in the Piedmont to being a threatened and frightened minority. Some folk had been literally chased from their homes to take refuge skulking in swamps and woods. Others had been beaten and badly injured.
"Even Farquhar Campbell," Duncan said, and rubbed a hand tiredly over his face. "The Committee of Safety called him before them, on charges of being loyal to the Crown, and threatened to confiscate his plantation. He put up a great deal of money, pledged as surety for his good behaviour, and they let him go, but it was a near thing."
Near enough to have frightened Duncan badly. The debacle of the promised guns and powder had deprived him of any influence with the local loyalists, and left him completely isolated, vulnerable to the next wave of hostilities, which any fool could see wouldn't be long in coming. He had therefore moved swiftly to sell River Run at a decent price before it was seized. He had kept one or two warehouses on the river, and a few other assets, but had disposed of the plantation, slaves, and livestock, and proposed to remove at once with his wife to Canada, as many other loyalists were doing.
"Hamish Mackenzie is there, Ken," he explained. "He and some others from Leoch settled in Nova Scotia when they left Scotland in the wake of Culloden. He's Jocasta's nephew, and we've money enough."
He glanced vaguely toward the hall where Ulysses had dumped the saddlebags.
"He'll help us to find a place."
He smiled crookedly.
"And if things shouldn't turn out well, they do say the fishing's good."
Jamie smiled at the feeble joke and poured him more whiskey, but he shook his head when he came to join me in the surgery before dinner.
"They mean to travel overland to Virginia, and with luck take ship there for Nova Scotia. They can perhaps get out of Newport News. It's a small port, and the British blockade isn't tight there, or so Duncan hopes."
Oh dear. It would be a grueling journey, and Jocasta wasn't a young woman. And the state of her eye. I wasn't fond of Jocasta, in light of what we had learned about her recently, but to think of her ripped from her home, forced to emigrate while suffering excruciating pain. Well, it caused one to think there might be such a thing as divine retribution after all. I lowered my voice, looking over my shoulder to be sure Duncan had in fact gone upstairs. "What about Ulysses? And Phaedra?" Jamie's lips pressed tight.
"Ah, well, as to the lass, I asked Duncan to sell her to me. I shall set her free as quickly as I can, perhaps send her to Fergus in New Bern." He agreed at once, and wrote out a bill of sale on the spot.
He nodded toward his office.
"As for Ulysses..."
His face was grim.
"I think that matter will adjust itself, Sassenach."
Mrs. Bugg came bustling down the hall to announce that supper was served, and I had no chance to ask him what he meant by that remark. I squeezed out the poultice of witch hazel and Carolina allspice and laid it gently over Jocasta's eyes. I'd already given her the willow bark tea for the pain, and the poultice would do nothing for the underlying glaucoma, but it would be soothing at least, and it was a relief to both patient and physician to be able to offer something, even though it might be the merest palliative.
"Will you have a keek in my saddlebags, lass?" she asked, stretching a little to ease herself on the bed. "There's a bitty parcel in there of an herb you might find of interest."
I found it immediately, by smell. "Where on earth did you get that?" I asked, halfway amused.
"Farquhar Campbell," she replied, matter-of-factly. "When you told me what the difficulty was with my eyes, I asked Fentiman if he kent anything that might be of help, and he told me that he'd heard somewhere that hemp might be of use. Farquhar Campbell has a field of it under cultivation, so I thought I might as well try it. It does seem to help. Would you put it in my hand, please, niece?"
Fascinated, I put the parcel of hemp and the little stack of papers down on the table beside her, and guided her hand to it. Rolling carefully onto her side to prevent the poultice falling off, she took a good pinch of aromatic herb, sprinkled it down the centre of the paper, and rolled as tidy a joint as I had ever seen in Boston. Without comment, I held the candle flame for her to light it, and she eased herself back on the pillow, nostrils flaring, as she took a deep lungful of smoke. She smoked in silence for some time, and I busied myself in putting things away, not wanting to leave her lest she fall asleep and set the bed on fire. She was clearly exhausted, and relaxing further by the moment. The pungent, heady smell of the smoke brought back instant, though fragmentary, memories. Several of the younger medical students had smoked it on weekends, and would come to the hospital with the scent of it in their clothes. Some of the people brought into the emergency room had reeked of it. Now and then, I'd smelled the faintest hint of it on Brianna, but never inquired. I hadn't ever tried it myself, but now found the smell of the fragrant smoke rather soothing. Rather too soothing, and I went and sat down by the window, open a crack, to admit fresh air. It had been raining off and on all day, and the air was sharp with ozone and tree resins, welcomely cold against my face.
"You know, don't you?"
Jocasta's voice came softly from behind me. I looked round. She hadn't moved, but lay like a tomb figure on the bed, straight as a die. The poultice bandage over her eyes made her look like the image of justice. Ironic, that, I thought.
"I know," I said, matching her own calm tone. "Not very fair to Duncan, was it?"
"No." The word drifted out with the smoke, almost soundless. She lifted the cigarette lazily and drew air through it, making the end glow red. I kept a narrow eye, but she seemed to have a feel for the ash, tapping it now and then into the saucer base of the candlestick.
"He knows, too," she said almost casually, "about Fed. I told him, finally, to stop him searching for her. I'm sure he knows about Ulysses, too, but he doesn't speak of it."
She reached out, unerring, and tapped the ash neatly from the joint.
"I told him I wouldn't blame him if he left me, Ken."
Her voice was very soft, nearly without emotion.
"He wept, but then he stopped, and said to me that he had said, for better or for worse. And so had I not? I said I had, and he said, well then. And here we are."
She shrugged a little, settling herself more comfortably, and fell silent, smoking. I turned my face again to the window and leaned my forehead against the frame. Below, I saw a sudden spill of light as the door opened and a dark figure came quickly out. The door closed, and I lost sight of him in the darkness for an instant. Then my eyes adapted, and I saw him again, just before he vanished on the path to the barn.
"He's gone, isn't he?"
Startled, I turned round to look at her, realizing that she must have heard the closing of the door below.
"Ulysses?"
"Yes, I think so." She was still for quite a while, the cigarette burning unregarded in her hand. Just before I thought I must rise and take it from her, she lifted it again to her lips.
"His true name
was Joseph, she said, softly releasing the smoke. Wisps of it swirled slowly in a cloud around his head.
So appropriate, I always thought, for he was sold into slavery by his own people.
Have you ever seen his face? I asked suddenly. She shook her head and ground out the last of the cigarette.
Nay, but I kent him always, she said very softly. He smelled of light.
Jamie Fraser sat patiently in the darkness of his barn. It was a small one, with stallage for only half a dozen animals, but soundly built. Rain beat solidly on the roof, and wind whined like a banshee round the corners, but not a drip came through the shingled roof, and the air inside was warm with the heat of somnolent beasts. Even Gideon was a nod over his manger, half-chewed hay hanging from the corner of his mouth. It was past midnight now, and he had been waiting for more than 2 hours, the pistol loaded and primed, resting on his knee. There it was. Above the rain, he heard the soft grunt of someone pushing at the door, and the rumble as it slid open, admitting a breath of cold rain to mingle with the warmer scents of hay and manure. He sat still, not moving. He could see a tall form pause against the lighter black of the rain-drenched night, waiting for his eyes to adapt to the dark within, then throw his weight against the heavy door to open it enough to slip inside. The man had brought a dark lantern, not trusting that he could find the necessary bits of harness and apply them in the dark. He drew back the slide and turned the lantern slowly, letting the shaft of light travel over the stalls one by one. The three horses Jocasta had brought were here, but done in. Jamie heard the man click his tongue softly in consideration, turning the light back and forth between the mare Jerusha and Gideon. Making up his mind, Ulysses set the lantern on the floor and made to pull the pin fastening the door to Gideon's stall.
"It would serve you right, and I'll let you take him," Jamie said conversationally.
The butler let out a sharp yelp and whirled round, glaring, his fists clenched. He couldn't see Jamie in the dark, but the evidence of his ears caught up with him a second later, and he breathed deeply and lowered his fists, realizing who it was.
"Mr. Fraser," he said.
His eyes were live in the lantern light and watchful.
"You took me by surprise."
"Well, I did intend to," Jamie replied equably.
"You mean to be off, I suppose."
He could see thoughts flit through the butler's eyes, quick as dragonflies, wondering, calculating. But Ulysses was no fool, and came to the correct conclusion.
"The girls told you, then," he said quite calmly. "Shall you kill me for your aunt's honour?"
Had that last been said with any trace of a sneer, Jamie might have killed him indeed. He'd been of two minds on the matter while he waited. But it was said simply, and Jamie's finger eased on the trigger.
"If I were a younger man, I would," he said, matching Ulysses' tone. "And if I did not have a wife and daughter who once called a black man friend." "As it is," he went on, lowering the pistol, "I try not to kill these days unless I must. Or until I must. Do you offer me denial? For I think there can be no defence."
The butler shook his head slightly. The light gleamed on his skin, dark, with a reddish undertone that made him look as though carved from aged cinnabar.
"I loved her," he said softly, and spread his hands. "Kill me."
He was dressed for travelling, in cloak and hat, with a pouch and canteen hung at his belt, but no knife. Slaves, even trusted ones, dared not go armed. Curiosity warred with distaste, and, as usual in such warfare, curiosity won.
"Phaedra said ye lay with my aunt, even before her husband died. Is that true?"
"It is," Ulysses said softly, his expression unreadable.
"I do not justify it. I cannot. But I loved her, and if I must die for that..."
Jamie believed the man. His sincerity was evident in voice and gesture. And knowing his aunt as he did, he was less inclined to blame Ulysses than the world at large would be. At the same time, he wasn't letting down his guard. Ulysses was good size and quick, and a man who thought he had nothing to lose was very dangerous indeed.
"Where did you mean to go?" he asked, with a nod toward the horses. "Virginia," the black man replied, with a barely perceptible hesitation. "Lord Dunsmore has offered freedom to any slave who will join his army."
He hadn't meant to ask, though it was a question that had raised itself in his mind from the moment he heard Phaedra's story. With this opening, though, he couldn't resist.
"Why did she not free you?" he asked, "after Hector Cameron died?"
"She did," was the surprising answer. The butler touched the breast of his coat.
"She wrote the papers of manumission nearly 20 years ago. She said she could not bear to think that I came to her bed only because I must. But a request for manumission must be approved by the Assembly, you know. And if I had been openly freed, I could not have stayed to serve her as I did."
That was true enough. A freed slave was compelled to leave the colony within 10 days or risk being enslaved again by anyone who chose to take him. The vision of large gangs of free Negroes roaming the countryside was one that made the council and assembly shit themselves with fear. The butler looked down for a moment, eyes hooded against the light.
"I could choose Joe or freedom."
"I chose her."
"Aye, very romantic," Jamie said with extreme dryness,
though in fact he wasn't unaffected by the statement. Jocasta Mackenzie had married for duty and duty again, and he thought she had had little happiness in any of her marriages until finding some measure of contentment with Duncan. He was shocked at her choice, disapproving of her adultery and very angry indeed at her deception of Duncan, but some part of him, the Mackenzie part doubtless, couldn't but admire her boldness in taking happiness where she could. He sighed deeply. The rain was easing now. The thundering on the roof had dwindled to a soft pattering.
"Well, then, I have one question more."
Ulysses inclined his head gravely, in a gesture Jamie had seen 1,000 times.
"At your service, sir," it said, and that was done with more irony than there was in anything the man had said. "Where's the gold?"
Ulysses' head jerked up, eyes wide with startlement. For the first time, Jamie felt a shred of doubt.
"You think I took it?"
the butler said incredulously. But then his mouth twisted to one side.
"I suppose you would, after all."
He rubbed a hand under his nose, looking worried and unhappy. As well he might, Jamie reflected. They stood regarding each other in silence for some time, at an impasse. Jamie didn't have the feeling that the other was attempting to deceive him.
"And God knew the man was good at that," he thought cynically.
At last, Ulysses heaved his wide shoulders and let them drop in helplessness.
"I cannot prove that I did not," he said. "I can offer nothing save my word of honour. And I am not entitled to have such a thing."
For the first time, bitterness rang in his voice. Jamie suddenly felt very tired. The horses and mules had long since gone back to their drowse, and he wanted nothing so much as his own bed and his wife beside him. He also wanted Ulysses to be gone, long before Duncan discovered his perfidy. And while Ulysses was patently the most obvious person to have taken the gold, the fact remained that he could have taken it any time in the last 20 years, with a good deal less danger. Why now?
"Will you swear on my aunt's head?" he asked abruptly.
Ulysses' eyes were sharp, shining in the lantern light, but steady.
"Yes,"
he said at last, quietly.
"I do so swear."
Jamie was about to dismiss him when one last thought occurred to him.
"Do you have children?" he asked.
Indecision crossed the chiselled face, surprise and wariness mingled with something else.
"None I would claim," he said at last,
and Jamie saw what it was, scorn mixed with shame. His jaw tensed and his chin rose slightly.
"Why do you ask me that?"
Jamie met his gaze for a moment, thinking of Brianna growing heavy with child.
"Because," he said at last, "it is only the hope of betterment for my children and theirs that gives me the courage to do what must be done here."
Ulysses' face had gone blank. It gleamed black and impassive in the light.
"If you have no stake in the future, you have no reason to suffer for it. Such children as you may have, they are slaves, born of slave women. What can they be to me?"
Ulysses' hands were clenched, pressed against his thighs.
"Then go,"
Jamie said softly, and stood aside, gesturing toward the door with the barrel of his pistol.
"Die free, at least."
Chapter 111. January the 21st. January the 21st, 1776. January the 21st was the coldest day of the year. Snow had fallen a few days before, but now the air was like cut crystal, the dawn sky so pale it looked white, and the packed snow chirped like crickets under our boots. Snow. Snow-shrouded trees. The icicles that hung from the eaves of the house. The whole world seemed blue with cold. All of the stock had been put up the night before in stable or barn, with the exception of the white sow, who appeared to be hibernating under the house. I peered dubiously at the small melted hole in the crust of snow that marked the sow's entrance. Long, stertorous snores were audible inside, and a faint warmth emanated from the hole.
"Come along, Munian. Yon creature wouldna notice if the house fell down atop her."
Jamie had come down from feeding the animals in the stable and was hovering impatiently behind me, chafing his hands in the big blue mittens Bree had knitted for him.
"What, not even if it was on fire?" I said, thinking of Lamb's essay on roast pork.
But I turned obligingly to follow him down the trampled path past the side of the house, then slowly, slipping on the icy patches, across the wide clearing toward Bree and Roger's cabin.
"You're sure the half fire's out?"
Jamie asked for the third time. His breath wreathed round his head like a veil as he looked over his shoulder at me. He had lost his woolen cap hunting, and instead had a woolly white muffler wrapped round his ears and tied on top of his head, the long ends flopping, which made him look absurdly like an enormous rabbit.
"It is,"
I assured him, suppressing an urge to laugh at sight of him. His long nose was pink with cold and twitched suspiciously, and I buried my face in my own muffler, making small snorting noises that emerged as puffs of white, like a steam engine.
"And the bedroom candle. The wee lamp in your surgery."
"Yes," I assured him, emerging from the depths of the muffler. My eyes were watering, and I would have liked to wipe them, but I had a huge bundle in one arm and a covered basket hung on the other. This contained Adso, who had been forcibly removed from the house and wasn't pleased about it. Small growls emerged from the basket, and it swayed and thumped against my leg. And the rush dip in the pantry, and the candle in the wall sconce in the hall, and the brazier in your office, and the fish oil lantern you use in the stables. I went over the whole house with a nit comb. Not a spark anywhere.
"Well enough, then," he said,
but couldn't help an uneasy glance backward at the house. I looked, too. It looked cold and forlorn, the white of its boards rather grimy against the pristine snow. "It won't be an accident," I said. "Not unless the white sow is playing with matches in her den." That made him smile, in spite of the circumstances. Frankly, at the moment, the circumstances struck me as slightly absurd. The whole world seemed deserted, frozen solid and immobile under a winter sky.
Nothing seemed less likely than that a cataclysm could descend to destroy the house by fire.
Still, better safe than sorry.
And, as Jamie had remarked more than once during the years since Roger and Bree had brought word of that sinister newspaper clipping, if you ken the house is meant to burn down on a certain day, why would you be standing in it?
So we weren't standing in it. Mrs. Bugg had been told to stay at home, and Amy McCullum and her two little boys were already at Brianna's cabin, puzzled but obliging. If himself said no one was to set foot in the house until dawn tomorrow, well then, there was nothing more to be said, was there?
Ian had been up since before dawn, chopping kindling and hauling in firewood from the shed. Everyone would be snug and warm. Jamie himself had been up all night, tending stock, dispersing his armoury. There wasn't a grain of gunpowder anywhere in the house either, and prowling restlessly upstairs and down, alert to every cracking ember on a hearth, every burning candle flame, any faint noise without that might portend the approach of an enemy. The only thing he hadn't done was to sit on the roof with a wet sack, keeping a suspicious eye out for lightning. And that only because it had been a cloudless night, the stars immense and bright overhead, burning in the frozen void. I hadn't slept a great deal either, disturbed equally by Jamie's prowling and by vivid dreams of conflagration. The only conflagration visible, though, was the one sending a welcome shower of smoke and sparks from Brianna's chimney, and we opened the door to the grateful warmth of a roaring hearth and a number of bodies. Aidan and Orrie, roused in the dark and dragged through the cold, had promptly crawled into Jemmy's trundle, and the three little boys were sound asleep, curled up like hedgehogs beneath their quilt. Amy was helping Bree with the breakfast. Savoury smells of porridge and bacon rose from the hearth.
"Is all well, ma'am?"
Amy hurried over to take the big bundle I had brought. This contained my medical chest, the more scarce and valuable herbs from my surgery, and the sealed jar with the latest shipment of white phosphorus that Lord John had sent as a farewell present to Brianna.
"It is," I assured her, setting Adso's basket on the floor.
I yawned and eyed the bed wistfully, but set about to stow my chest in the lean-to pantry, where the children wouldn't get into it. I put the phosphorus on the highest shelf, well back from the edge, and moved a large cheese in front of it, just in case. Jamie had divested himself of cloak and rabbit ears, and, handing Roger the fowling piece, shot pouch and powder horn he'd carried, was stamping snow from his boots. I saw him glance round the cabin, counting heads, then at last draw a small breath, nodding to himself.
"All safe, so far."
The morning passed peacefully, breakfast eaten and cleared away. Amy, Bree and I settled down by the fire with an enormous heap of mending. Adso, tail still twitching with indignation, had taken up a place on a high shelf from whence he glared at Rollo, who had taken over the trundle bed when the boys got out of it. Aidan and Jemmy, each now the proud possessor of two rooms, drove them over half-stones under the bed and through our feet, but for the most part refrained from punching each other or stepping on Orrie, who was sitting placidly under the table gnawing on a piece of toast. Jamie, Roger and Ian took turns going outside to pace back and forth and stare at the big house, deserted in the shelter of the snow-dusted spruce. As Roger came back from one of these expeditions, Brianna looked up suddenly from the sock she was darning.
"What?" he said, seeing her face.
"Oh!" She had paused, needle halfway through the sock, and now looked down, completing her stitch.
"Nothing. Just a thought."
The tone of her voice made Jamie, who had been frowning his way through a battered copy of Evelina, look up.
"What sort of thought was that, Ian?"
he asked, his radar quite as good as Roger's.
Well.
She bit her lower lip, but then blurted,
"What if it's this house?"
That froze everyone except the little boys, who continued crawling industriously around the room and over bed and table, screeching and vrooming.
It could be, couldn't it?
Bree looked round from roof tree to hearth.
All the prophecy said,
with an awkward nod toward Amy McCullum,
was the home of James Fraser would burn. But this was your home to start with. And it's not like there's a street address.
It just said, on Fraser's Ridge.
Everyone stared at her, and she flushed deeply, dropping her eyes to the sock. I mean, it's not like they, prophecies. Like they're always accurate, is it? They might have got the details wrong.
Amy nodded seriously. Evidently, vagueness in the matter of detail was an accepted characteristic of prophecies. Roger cleared his throat explosively. Jamie and Ian exchanged glances, then looked at the fire leaping on the hearth, and the towering stack of bone-dry firewood next to it, the overflowing kindling basket. Everyone's eyes turned expectantly to Jamie, whose face was a study in conflicting emotions.
"I suppose," he said slowly, "we could remove to Archie's place."
I began to count on my fingers. You, me, Roger, Bree, Ian, Amy, Aidan, Ori, Jemmy, plus Mr. and Mrs. Bug, is 11 people. In a one-room cabin that measures 8 feet by 10? I closed my fists and stared at him. No one would have to set the place on fire. Half of us would be sitting in the hearth already, well alight.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, the Christie place is empty.
Amy's eyes went round with horror, and everyone looked automatically away from everyone else. Jamie took a deep breath and let it out audibly.
Perhaps we'll just be very careful, I suggested.
Everyone exhaled slightly, and we resumed our occupations, though without our former sense of snug safety. Dinner passed without incident, but in mid-afternoon a knock came on the door. Amy screamed, and Brianna dropped the shirt she was mending into the fire. Ian leapt to his feet and jerked the door open, and Rollo, jerked out of a doze, charged past him, roaring. Jamie and Roger struck the doorway and each other simultaneously, stuck for an instant, and fell through. All the little boys shrieked and ran to their respective mothers, who were frantically beating at the smouldering shirt as though it were a live snake. I had leapt to my feet but was pressed against the wall, unable to get past Bree and Amy. Adso, startled by the racket and by my popping up beside him, hissed and took a swipe at me, narrowly missing my eye. A number of oaths in a mixture of languages were coming from the dooryard, accompanied by a series of sharp barks from Rollo. Everyone sounded thoroughly annoyed, but there were no sounds of conflict. I edged my way delicately past the knot of mothers and sons and peered out. Major MacDonald, wet to the eyebrows and covered in clumps of snow and dirty slush, was gesticulating with some energy at Jamie, while Ian rebuked Rollo and Roger, from the look on his face, was trying very hard not to burst out laughing. Jamie, compelled by his own sense of propriety, but eyeing the Major with deep suspicion, invited him in. The inside of the cabin smelled of burned fabric, but at least the riot had calmed down, and the Major greeted us all with a fair assumption of cordiality. There was a lot of fuss getting him stripped of his soaking wet clothes, dried off, and, for lack of any better alternative, temporarily swathed in Roger's spare shirt and breeches, in which he appeared to be drowning, as he was a good 6 inches shorter than Roger. Food and whiskey having been ceremonially offered and accepted, the household fixed the Major with a collective eye and waited to hear what had brought him to the mountains in the dead of winter. Jamie exchanged a brief glance with me, indicating that he could hazard a guess. So could I.
"I have come, sir," MacDonald said formally, hitching up the shirt to keep it from sliding off his shoulder, "to offer ye command of a company of militia
under the orders of General Hugh MacDonald. The General's troops are gathering even as we speak, and will undertake their march to Wilmington at the end of the month."
I felt a deep qualm of apprehension at that. I was accustomed to MacDonald's chronic optimism and tendency to overstatement, but there was nothing of exaggeration in this statement. Did that mean that the help Governor Martin had requested, the troops from Ireland, would be landing soon, to meet General MacDonald's troops at the coast?
"The General's troops?" Jamie said, poking up the fire.
He and MacDonald had taken over the fireside, with Roger and Ian ranged on either side of them like fire dogs. Bree, Amy, and I repaired to the bed, where we perched like a row of roosting hens, watching the conversation with a mingling of interest and alarm, while the little boys retired under the table.
"How many men does he have, would you see, Donald?"
I saw MacDonald hesitate, torn between truth and desire. He coughed, though, and said matter-of-factly, "He had a few more than 1,000 when I left him.
You can wheel, though. Once we begin to move, others will come to join us. Many others. The more particularly," he added pointedly, "if such gentlemen as yourself are in command."
Jamie didn't reply to that at once. Meditatively, he shoved a burning wood fragment back into the fire with his foot.
"Powder and shot?" he asked. "Arms?"
"Aye, well, we'd a bit of a disappointment there."
MacDonald took a sip of his whiskey.
"Duncan Innes had promised us a great deal in that way, but in the end he was obliged to renege upon his promise."
The Major's lips pressed tight, and I thought, from the expression on his face, that perhaps Duncan hadn't been overreacting in his decision to move to Canada.
"Still," MacDonald continued more cheerfully, "we are not destitute in that regard, and those gallant gentlemen who have flocked to our cause, and who will come to join us, bring with them both their own weapons and their courage. You of all people must appreciate the force of the Hieland charge."
Jamie looked up at that, and regarded MacDonald for a long moment before replying.
"Aye, well, you were behind the cannon at Culloden, Donald. I was in front of them, with a sword in my hand."
He took up his own glass and drained it, then got up and moved to pour another, leaving MacDonald to recover his countenance.
"Touché, Major," Brianna murmured under her breath.
I didn't think Jamie had ever before referred to the fact that the Major had fought with the government forces during the Rising, but I wasn't surprised that he hadn't forgotten. With a brief nod to the company, Jamie stepped outside, ostensibly to visit the privy, more likely to check on the well-being of the house, still more likely to give MacDonald a little breathing room. Roger, with the courtesy of a host and the suppressed keenness of a historian, was asking MacDonald questions regarding the General and his activities. Ian, impassive and watchful, sat by the fire, one hand toying with Rollo's ruff.
"The General's rather elderly for such a campaign, surely?"
Roger took another stick of wood and pushed it into the fire.
"Especially a winter campaign."
"He has the odd wee spell of catarrh," MacDonald admitted offhand. "But who doesn't in this climate? And Donald MacLeod, his lieutenant, is a man of vigour. I assure you, sir, should the General be at any point indisposed, Colonel MacLeod is more than capable of leading the troops to victory."
He went on at some length about the virtues, both personal and military, of Donald MacLeod. I ceased listening, my attention distracted by a stealthy movement on the shelf above his head.
"Add so."
MacDonald's red coat was spread over the back of a chair to dry, steaming in the heat. His wig, damp and dishevelled from Rollo's attack, hung on the cloak peg above it. I got up hastily and possessed myself of the wig, receiving a look of puzzlement from the Major, and one of green-eyed hostility from Adso, who plainly considered it low of me to hog this desirable prey for myself.
I'll just put it somewhere safe, shall I?
Clutching the damp mass of horsehair to my bosom, I sidled outside and round to the pantry, where I tucked the wig safely away behind the cheese with the phosphorus. Coming out, I met Jamie, red-nosed with cold, coming back from a reconnaissance of the big house.
"All's well," he assured me.
He glanced up at the chimney above us, spuming clouds of thick grey smoke.
"You dinna suppose the lass might be right, do you?"
He sounded as though he were joking, but he wasn't.
God knows. How long till tomorrow's dawn?
The shadows were already falling, long, violet, and chill across the snow.
Too long.
He had violet shadows in his face, too, from one sleepless night. This would be another. He hugged me against himself for a moment, though, warm in spite of the fact that he wore nothing over his shirt but the rough jacket in which he did chores.
"You dinna suppose MacDonald will come back and fire the house if I refuse him, do you?"
he asked, releasing me with a fair attempt at a smile.
"What do you mean, if?" I demanded, but he was already on his way back in.
MacDonald stood up in respect when Jamie came in, waiting until he was seated again before taking his own stool.
"Have you had a moment, then, to think on my offer, Mr. Fraser?" he asked formally. "Your presence would be of the greatest value, and valued greatly by General MacDonald and the Governor, as well as myself."
Jamie sat silent for a moment, looking into the fire.
"It grieves me, Donald, that we should find ourselves so opposed," he said at last, looking up. "You canna be in ignorance, though, of my position in this matter. I have declared myself."
MacDonald nodded, lips tightening a little.
"I ken what you've done, but it's not too late for remedy. You've done nothing yet that is irrevocable, and a man may surely admit mistake."
Jamie's mouth twitched a little.
"Oh, aye, Donald. Might you admit your own mistake, then, and join the cause of liberty?"
MacDonald drew himself up.
"It may please you to tease, Mr. Fraser," he said, obviously keeping a grip on his temper, "but my offer is made in earnest." "I know that, Major. My apologies for undue levity. And also for the fact that I must make ye a poor reward of your efforts, coming so far in bitter weather." "You refuse, then?"
Red smudges burned on MacDonald's cheeks, and his pale blue eyes had gone the colour of the winter sky.
"You will abandon your kin, your ain folk? You would betray your blood as well as your oath?"
Jamie had opened his mouth to reply, but stopped at this. I could feel something going on inside him. Shock at this blunt and very accurate accusation. Hesitation. He had never discussed the situation in those terms, but he must have grasped them. Most of the Highlanders in the colony either had joined the Loyalist side already, like Duncan and Jocasta, or likely would. His declaration had cut him off from a great many friends, and might well cut him off from the remnants of his family in the New World as well. Now MacDonald was holding out the apple of temptation, the call of clan and blood. But he had had years to think of it, to ready himself.
"I have said what I must, Donald," he said quietly. "I have pledged myself and my house to what I believe is right. I cannot do otherwise."
MacDonald sat for a moment, looking at him narrowly. Then, without a word, he stood and pulled Roger's shirt off over his head. His torso was pale and lean, but with a slight middle-aged softness round the waist, and wore several white scars, the marks of bullet wounds and sabre cuts.
"You don't mean to go, surely, Major? It's freezing out and nearly dark."
I came to stand by Jamie and Roger, and Bree rose too, adding their protestations to mine. MacDonald, though, was obdurate, merely shaking his head as he pulled on his own damp clothing, fastening his coat with difficulty as the buttonholes were stiff with damp.
"'I will not take hospitality from the hand of a traitor, mum,' he said very quietly, and bowed to me.
He straightened then, and met Jamie's eye, man to man.
"'We shall not meet again as friends, Mr. Fraser,' he said. "'I regret it.'
"'Then let us hope we do not meet again at all, Major,' Jamie said. "'I, too, regret it.'
MacDonald bowed again to the rest of the company and clapped his hat on his head. His expression changed as he did so and felt the damp coldness of it on his bare head. "'Oh, your wig. Just a moment, Major. I'll fetch it.' I rushed out and round to the pantry, just in time to hear a crash as something fell inside. I jerked open the door, left a jar from my last visit, and Adzo streaked past me, the Major's wig in his mouth. Inside, the lean-to was in brilliant blue flames. I had initially wondered how I would keep awake all night. In the event, it wasn't difficult at all. In the aftermath of the blaze, I wasn't sure I'd ever sleep again. It could have been much worse. Major MacDonald, in spite of now being a sworn enemy, had come nobly to our aid, rushing out and flinging his still-wet cloak over the blaze, thus preventing the total destruction of the pantry, and doubtless the cabin. The cloak hadn't put out the fire entirely, though, and quenching the flames that sprang up here and there had entailed a great deal of excitement and rushing about, in the course of which Orrie McCullum was misplaced, toddled off, and fell into the groundhog kiln, where he was found many frantic minutes later by Rollo. He was fished out undamaged, but the hullabaloo caused Brianna to have what she thought was premature labour. Fortunately, this proved to be merely a bad case of hiccups, caused by the combination of nervous strain and eating excessive quantities of sauerkraut and dried apple pie, for which she had conceived a recent craving.
"Flammable," she said.
Jamie looked at the charred remains of the pantry floor, then at Brianna, who had, in spite of my recommendation that she lie down, come out to see what could be salvaged from the smoking remains. He shook his head.
"'It's a miracle that you've not burnt the place to ashes long since, lass.'
She emitted a smothered "hup" and glowered at him, one hand on her bulging stomach.
"'Me? You'd better not be trying to make out that this is my fault. Did I put the Major's wig next to the—'
"'Boo!'
Roger bellowed, darting a hand at her face. She shrieked and hit him. Jemmy and Aidan, running out to see what the commotion was about, started dancing round her, ecstatically shouting, "'Boo! Boo!' like a gang of miniature lunatic ghosts. Bree, her eyes gleaming dangerously, bent and scooped up a handful of snow. In an instant, she had moulded it into a ball which she flung at her husband's head with deadly accuracy. It struck him right between the eyes, exploding in a shower that left white granules clinging to his eyebrows and melting globs of snow running down his cheeks.
"What?" he said incredulously. "What's that for? I was only trying to—"
"Hey!"
He ducked the next one, only to be pelted round the knees and waist by hands full of snow lobbed at short range by Jemmy and Aidan, quite berserk by now. Modestly accepting thanks for his action earlier, the Major had been persuaded, not least by the fact that it was now full dark and beginning to snow again, to accept the hospitality of the cabin, with the understanding that it was Roger, not Jamie, who was offering it. Watching his hosts whooping and hiccuping as they plastered one another with snow, he looked as though he might be having second thoughts about being so fine as to refuse to dine with a traitor. But he rather stiffly bowed in response when Jamie and I bade him farewell, then trudged into the cabin, the muddy shreds that Adso had left of his wig clasped in his hand. It seemed extremely and most gratefully quiet as we made our way through the falling snow toward our own house, alone. The sky had gone a pinkish lavender, and the flakes floated down around us, supernatural in their silence. The house loomed before us, its quiet bulk somehow welcoming, in spite of the darkened windows. Snow was swirling across the porch in little eddies, piling in drifts on the sills. I suppose it would be harder for a fire to start if it's snowing, wouldn't you think? Jamie bent to unlock the front door.
I didn't mind much if the place bursts into flame by spontaneous combustion, Sassenach, provided I have my supper first.
A cold supper, were you thinking? I asked dubiously.
I was not, he said firmly. I mean to light a roaring fire in the kitchen hearth, fry up a dozen eggs in butter, and eat them all. Then lay ye down on the hearth rug, and roger ye till you...
Is that all right? He inquired, noticing my look.
Till I what?
I asked, fascinated by his description of